you very much. I was just commenting that the acoustics in here reminds me of church, and I'm looking at the front tables here. Nobody's sitting in the front, just like church. Anyway, I want to say thank you very much for coming to our P3 listening session. Welcome. Everybody hear me okay? Okay. Anybody hearing me too much? Okay, we're good. My name is Regina McElroy, and I am the director of the Office of Innovative Program Delivery in the Federal Highway Administration. And my office is charged with developing model P3 contracts, those contracts that we're going to be talking about today. We have about 100 people here. I think a really good turnout, and I think it speaks to the importance of this effort and certainly the interest in this effort. As you know, Congress directed us via MAP 21 to develop standard public-private partnership transaction models. The good news is that other than saying that we should encourage their ultimate use, Congress didn't tell us anything more about what we need to do with these contracts. So what that means is that we have the ability to kind of shape the look and feel of these templates, and that's very much where you guys come in. This is our first effort to solicit input. We're doing this listening session. We also opened a public docket that will stay open for a number of months, and we encourage you all to write to the docket as well. So I'm very happy you're here, and it's going to be enormously helpful to us to hear your comments so that we can do a good job on developing these templates and that they can be templates that are actually used and valued. I have a little bit more to say about this, but before I really get started, I want to introduce Beth Osborne. Beth has graciously accepted our invitation to provide a few opening remarks. Beth is the department's Deputy Assistant Secretary for Transportation Policy. She started with USDOT in 2009. And I tell you, she has been very, very busy since the first day that she arrived. She has overseen the implementation of TIGER, a huge, huge job. And she's supported the Secretary's Livability Initiative. And right now, she is at the lead for MAP 21 implementation. So let me ask Beth to step up and give us a few opening comments. And again, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Regina. I'm glad everybody's here today. This is a good room. I'm really excited to be here, and we at the department are excited about the growing use of P3s. State and local leaders around the country are spearheading efforts to bring P3 into their toolkit in terms of delivering projects, and that is a use of delivery method. At the federal level, we are trying to come up with ways to be more helpful in this. We are trying to utilize our tools to a greater extent to support those efforts and encourage them where possible. And we are very excited, particularly at these difficult funding times, to see their growing use. We know that it's going to be essential to delivering particularly large and important projects. We also recognize the benefit, and we've seen it in TIGER. We've seen we're allowed to do more innovative financing through TIGER as well. And we've seen that P3s spur innovation through a competitive procurement process. We see that it accelerates project delivery and reduces project costs. We see that it promotes an efficient and effective decision-making process. These are all things we would like to see become more of a regular part of DOT's processes. But we also recognize that there are challenges here, especially for those that don't have a lot of experience in this area. P3s have to be well-structured to balance risk and responsibilities between the public and the private sector. They also need to deliver value in comparison to traditional public approaches to funding and delivery. And finally, they need to target public sector objectives. And on those last two, you know, comparing the benefits with regard to a P3 versus traditional project delivery methods, you can look at it in terms of just a financial transaction, what it's going to cost, which saves the state more money. But I think that analysis has to include some of the other structural challenges for those states, particularly that might be new to this. or institutions that might be new to this. There is the institutional expertise that needs to be developed, but there's also the communications with the public, with the public at large. I used to work for a senator from Delaware, and I saw what happened when a P3 was not properly communicated to the public, and it was not made clear to them what are the public sector benefits of a project. And it doesn't matter how good your numbers are if you haven't done that part right. And so doing the all three of those aspects and managing that properly is really key to getting this done well. MAP 21, our authorization bill, which is dominating all of our lives here at DOT, has charged us with compiling best practices for P3, and as Regina just mentioned, developing model contracts for the most popular types of P3s. As with our broader MAP 21 outreach, we want this outreach to be extensive and broad. We want to bring people from the public and private sectors, from developers and operators, from lenders, from equity investors, from technical and financial and legal advisors and labor all into a room together separately, every way you can imagine, in order to extract as much information from you all and from your experience as we can. We also want to make sure that we produce materials that are useful to our customers, state and local governments, no matter where they are in the P3 process, whether you are a state that has a very sophisticated program and has several already underway, or whether you're a state that's taking the first steps into the process. So part of what we would like to hear today is how can we be all things to all people, I suppose. Anyway, we're very glad to have you here today. We're looking forward to what you have to tell us and look forward to working with you as this process moves forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Beth. Appreciate it. Got us off to a good start here. Okay, so what I want to do now is to go over the goals for this session, walk through the format for this afternoon, and then go over just a few logistical details. So, as I indicated earlier, this is an assignment that we received from Congress, and let me ask for the next slide. And let me just walk through what Congress has asked us to do. First of all, you see that we have to have our work completed by the end of this year, by December of this year. This is a very, very big task to do in a very short period of time. Second, you will note that we are charged with developing standard P3 transaction model contracts for the most popular types of public-private partnerships for the development, financing, construction, and operation transportation facilities. And finally, the language calls for us to encourage states, public transportation agencies, and other public officials to use the model contracts as a base template when developing their own P3 agreements. So, next slide. So, what you can see here, as I said earlier, is there is considerable room to define what these templates will look like. And frankly, there's considerable space to figure out how they should be used, what purpose they should serve. For instance, should they be more educational or more prescriptive? These are important considerations, but important questions that Congress has not given us the answer to. And that's very much what we're looking for from you. We're looking for your thoughts. So what we're going to do is we're going to walk through that agenda. What we're going to start with is the format of the contract, and again, this is where we're going to get into, so what's their purpose? How do you think that these contracts will be used? We have the given that we're going to have contracts, and then the next question is, so how are they going to be used? So we'll spend some time talking about that, as a matter of fact, 45 minutes. And then we're going to talk about the scope of the templates, and that is in general, what should be included in these templates. Once we finish that conversation, what we want to do is to talk about the specific provisions that should be included in the templates. And then finally, we want your input on what sorts of transactions we should start with when we're developing these templates. You know, there's a lot of ways you can kind of slice and dice this exercise. Should we look at types of facilities? Should we look at types of concessions? And that's what, again, we're looking for your input on that. So what we're going to do is we're going to have Deborah Brown Davis, who's sitting here, tee up each subject. She's going to ask a few questions. By all means, these are not all inclusive. Again, we're looking to you for a whole lot of thinking on these points. And then we have 45 minutes of discussion, and then we'll just walk right on through that agenda. So Deborah has been with Federal Highway for a number of years now, and she's leading the team that's responsible for public-private partnerships in Federal Highway. She came to us immediately before this assignment from the Virginia Department of Transportation, where she was a very key player in the Capitol Beltway Hot Lanes project. And of course, this was it was the first P3 in Virginia and one of the early P3s in the country. Now, there are going to be three of us kind of roaming around the room, myself, Mark Sullivan, and Jake Falk, who's back there. We're all going to have microphones. You won't have to get up and go, pardon me? Oh, I'm listening to the people behind me. We're all going to have microphones, and you won't have to get up out of your seats. Just raise your hand, and there we will be. So let me introduce Jake a little bit. He's the director of the Office of Infrastructure Finance and Innovation in the Office of the Secretary of Transportation. And he advises the Office of the Secretary on policy matters related to infrastructure finance and innovation, to include the department's credit assistance programs, P3s, and tolling and pricing. Jake also played a very key role in implementing the department's TIGER program, something that occupied his time for a number of years, that he did a really great job on. And I think significantly for this effort, Jake came to DOT from the private sector, where he worked for Chadbourne, and in that capacity, he negotiated a number of P3 arrangements, which today are considered to be truly groundbreaking. So we're happy to have him, and I should say that Jake and Mark and myself are all going to feel free to ask follow-up questions and spur the conversation as necessary. So Mark Sullivan, again, will also have a microphone. Mark is the senior advisor for the Office of Innovative Program Delivery. He has enormous experience with project finance and indeed served as head of the TIFIA program for a number of years, so we're happy to have him. And as I said, I too will have a mic. So again, let me just underscore the idea is raise your hand when you have something to say and we will be right there to help you say it. Now, my hope with this listening session is that you will hear very little from the USDOT folks in this room. We put this session together. You know, we could have just said, you're welcome to provide comments to the docket, but we didn't want to do that. We wanted to put a session together where we would literally encourage a dialogue and encourage the exchange of good ideas. And what I'm hoping is that DJ will say something, and somebody else will say to themselves, that doesn't make sense, or it does make sense, it gives me a good idea, and raise their hand and follow along on those lines. So what we're hoping for is that we're very much, the USDOT folks are very much in the background, we're facilitating, we're not directing, and I think in that way we will get some good ideas. And I also want to stress that we really do have a clean slate here. We're not going into this with a whole lot of preconceived notions. We've talked a lot about it back at the office, and the conclusion that we've come to is that this is a big, difficult, challenging task. There's a lot of ways we could approach it, and so we're very excited, enthusiastic to hear from the folks in this audience as kind of our first effort of reach out. Before I hand it off to Deborah, let me just say a few more things. First, regarding logistics, we're not going to have any formal breaks. We've got 4 hours, which seems like a really long time, but I don't think it will be when you look at the agenda and how it's broken out. So we didn't want to waste time on breaks. So feel free when you want to get up and take care of whatever. You can go back through that side and just keep walking, and you'll see restrooms on the left-hand side. So again, it's up to you whenever you want to take a break. Won't hurt our feelings. Second, I want to introduce Prabhat Dixit. and I'm looking for Prabhat. There he is. He's got two hands up there in the back. Prabhat has done a fabulous job organizing this. Everything that you see here is a result of his efforts. He drafted the Federal Register notice, and it will be Prabhat that leads this overall effort. So if you want to whisper in his ear at any point, by all means, he's here and would love to hear your comments publicly, obviously, and privately as well. So he will be seeing this effort through. And then I also want to introduce Patrick DeCarlo Souza. Patrick is also a member of Deborah's team, and he serves as our P3 project manager. I want to put in a plug for something. It's the only point that I'll deviate from our task here, but Patrick has been working very, very hard on a P3 toolkit. He rolled it out at TRB. A number of elements are up on our website. I would certainly encourage you to Google us, Office of Innovative Program Delivery, and you're go straight to where we are. There's a lot of material there. He put together an analytical tool that we're calling P3 Value, and I think it's very consistent with what we're trying to do here today, in that it's another effort that we have going on to help practitioners implement P3s that are not only effective, but that are also done in the public interest. So Patrick is another resource, and he would be interested to talk to you as well. Finally, the folks from the Volpe Transportation Systems Center are sitting over there. If you have any logistical questions, you should ask them. Michael Kay, who just raised his hand. We also have Myrna, I guess, out in the front, and Kevin McDonald. And Kevin?
Okay.
But anyway, they've done a great job setting this up, and there's just a lot of work that goes into putting this together. And with that, I will turn it over to Deborah. And again, thank you for being here, and I'm so looking forward to your comments.
Good afternoon. Just one other minor logistical thing, or maybe not so minor, depending on where you're sitting. Since we're going from noon to 4, I understand some people might get a little hungry. There's a kiosk right behind the curtain back there to the left, or to my left, where you might be able to purchase something if you would like a snack before we wrap up. Okay, as Regina said, I'm just going to introduce the topics. And the bullet points or the questions that you see here are, again, not indicative of the direction in which we're headed. They're just here in order to spur your thought processes. If you have something else that's not specifically addressed by a particular question, please feel free to add in your other thoughts related to the broad topic. But we want to start off talking about the framework for what the model contracts should look like. Do you think we should be working towards developing fully fleshed out model contracts with recommended language covering all the possible provisions that might be required in any P3 agreement? Or should we look towards focusing on recommended language for common provisions that where across the board there may be some commonality of approach or desired commonality of approach? With only placeholders for some of the other provisions that are likely to vary widely. Should we simply outline what the minimum provisions should be in any contract and include a menu of options that might be chosen to address a particular project sponsor's policy objectives or goals? Also, should there be any attachments that we look to develop, such as common definitions or performance measures? Maybe we should look towards simply a suggestive list of attachments that are likely to be needed in any agreement. What about the proposal solicitation? Do you think we should even start that early in terms of packaging together? You know, ultimately these P3 agreements are comprised of volumes of documents several inches thick. So how much of that should we be looking to address, or should we simply stick to the commercial terms agreement? So with that, I'm going to open it up to questions. Again, feel free to raise your hand. By the fact that your hand's not raised, that we're not going to make that assumption that you don't have anything to say. We know many of you. We have no shame about calling on you. And I've told several of you about that in advance, so be ready.
Okay.
There's DJ.
Thank you, DJ.
Are you gonna...
There always has to be a first.
Thank you, Regina and Deborah. Let me start by just thanking you for having this listening session. I think this is the type of issue that's very hard to do with formal written comments as part of a traditional docket procedure. And I think starting off the process by actually asking, you know, what do people think, and having a dialogue around that makes a lot more sense, is far more effective. I guess I would start with just a question about, you know, should we have a little conversation about the end goal of this? Because when I saw the language in the statute, I thought that's very helpful, because one of the challenges the U.S. has in the P3 industry is every P3 transaction is bespoke. It's almost as if we just start with a blank sheet of paper every time, and there's not a whole lot of reliance on precedent. And so having both representing governments and kind of on the bid side as well, from a government standpoint, it's very hard when a government for the very first time is putting together a P3 transaction to try to understand what is commercial, what is a good deal, what makes sense, and how do we end up with an agreement that really is a good deal for our taxpayers and our citizens. So I think as part of this exercise, it would be very helpful to have less very specific contract language and more sort of like a term sheet approach with general provisions, and then help explain why some of those provisions are in the agreement, and maybe a little bit more of a spread. But I don't know what it is that you're aiming for an end document, but if the process ends with something that states could use as a tool to determine what the spectrum is, that would be very helpful.
Let me say, and this is a good opportunity for me to underscore something. We don't have an aim right now. That's why you're here. We're trying to understand, would it be better to have, and what I hear you saying is almost more of an educational document, and I'm seeing some agreement here. You're next to talk, so I want you to think of what you want to say. So we could have a kind of an educational tool, or we could have something more prescriptive. I do think that there are some trade-offs. One, obviously, there's a benefit to having a kind of an educational approach, and I think DJ articulated that well. But on the other hand, there might be a benefit to having some standardization. It might be easier for concessionaires to deal with us. That's been a long-standing complaint, 50 states, 50 new whatevers, you know, and that's a problem. And it might provide almost some cover and comfort for states that are entering into these to kind of have a good housekeeping seal of approval on something. So something to, you know, those trade-offs I think are worthwhile considering.
Thanks. Hank Webster from the American Road and Transportation Builders Association. I want to echo what DJ said. We did outreach to our members, you know, concessionaires, engineers, contractors, state officials, and one of the sort of main themes across the board was sort of a fear, not a terror, but a fear that, you know, what may start off as educational or encouragement to use will result someday in, you know, prescription and, you know, tying to availability of funds or financing. So I think, you know, more on the side of education will be great. I mean, I think there is a lot of work to do to get some standardization, or at least, you know, availability for states to be able to learn, you know, what provisions should be in there, what other states have looked at, you know, sort of maybe the three best provisions from across different contracts, things like that. But there was some fear of, you know, being locked into some things, particularly with the term public protection. You know, everybody wants to protect the public, but is that going to result in toll rate caps, or, you know, you can't do things this way, you can't do things that way? You know, we very much recognize that there is a government role still in the negotiation of these contracts, so we hope that's on the road to public protection enough. But we were all very excited to see this in Map 21 and excited to see sort of going down the road of education on this issue, because there is so much variety amongst the states.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, if I may, Ed Crooks with Booz Allen, and I wanted to pick up, I think, on one of the comments the last speaker was making, and that's, I think I know the answer to this, but we ought to, I would suggest that DOT be very, very clear that if a project sponsor uses one of these standard contract templates, it doesn't confer any special privileges to them with respect to access to federal credit assistance. Now, that's partly a question. I think I know the answer to it, but if in fact DOT was going to look more favorably on an applicant that used one of these standard contracts in a TIFIA application or a RIF application, then that changes the game dramatically. I don't think that's the case, and we probably ought to be clear about that at the outset.
Okay. Thank you.
This gentleman was next. Okay. And if you could introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Matt Reifer with the American Council of Engineering Companies. To DJ's point about every P3 being unique and starting sort of with a blank document, to that point, ACEC has a joint committee with ASCE and with NSPE, the professional engineers and the civil engineers, that's developing and has developed joint contract documents, outlining the role of engineers across the scope of all sorts of different projects. They've got a subcommittee that is currently developing model contracts for P3s. So I think there's a confluence there from that effort with our organizations and with this provision in the law and what DOT is doing. That subcommittee's meeting in February. They've been doing a lot of work already. But as that process continues, I want to be sure that our people are in touch with your people, as it were. And I'll put that information into the docket and the record so you've got all the appropriate contact information and who's who and who's doing what. But from the engineering perspective, we are developing our own model contracts so that the folks that are involved are starting with something when they sit down to negotiate with all the different parties that are involved. So just want to make sure everybody's aware of that effort from ASCE and ACEC and others.
Thank you. I wasn't aware of that, and that is useful information. Appreciate that.
One administrative note is please hold the microphones close to your mouth because we're in an open room to make sure everybody can hear. Thanks.
Thank you, Jake. Oh, my. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think this gentleman right here is.
Hi. I'm Sue Lee from Ernst & Young. I just wanted to say one difficulty, I think, with getting too prescriptive and detailed with the contract form and responding to Deborah's question about procurement documents is that P3 legislation isn't uniform across the states. And so it'd be really tough to try to enact a sample form of contract that addresses all the variants in the actual legislation.
Hi, I'm Andrew Fraser from Allen & Overy. I think our view on this is that that there's really, I guess, the overarching objective should be to produce something that will be of most value, and to set off with an objective that can be achieved within your time framework, because in the context of undertaking this sort of exercise, which has been done several times in different forms around the world, 12 months is actually not a very long period of time. It's actually a comparatively short period of time. and so if you kind of take a step back and look at your question around standardization versus education, I think as an opinion we would say actually what we would encourage is a bit of one aspect of that and a lot of the other. And I think on the standardization, our experience in the field right now and over the last few years is that where we would really benefit, projects would really benefit from standardization early, is actually hearing from federal government about what its requirements are for specific provisions where there's federal assistance for a project. So to be perfectly candid with you, far too many projects that are receiving federal assistance, particularly through the TIFIA program, are hearing about requirements of provisions that have to go into the contracts far too late. right, in the procurement process. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be beneficial if it's possible to standardize and actually articulate in a document what particular provisions do have to go into a contract if that project is receiving federal assistance. And my hope and belief and expectation would be that that doesn't morph into a contract in its entirety, which goes to Ed's point. Then if you then move outside of that, I think our strong recommendation would be that everything is about education. And the reason for that is that if you actually look at what's going on around the US, and there's views as to whether this is a good or a bad thing, but it's not that uncommon for the legal advisors, the attorneys to be brought on relatively late in the process, or certainly later than the technical guys and the financial guys. And this is not a plea for state DOTs to bring lawyers on earlier in the process. But if you think about it, a contractual framework is one of the last pieces in the jigsaw, really, and rightly so, that gets put together. What state DOTs or procuring authorities are trying to do needs to be fleshed out and established before the contract is actually written. And I think to just produce a contract is going to be a bit of a blunt instrument in terms of educating DOTs. To give you an example, a lot of risk allocation that's set out in standard contracts is predicated on an assumption that a certain amount of work has been done by a procuring authority in advance of releasing the contract. And so the volume of information that you would have to give to procuring authorities to make a standard contract credible would be so immense that you would certainly never achieve it in the timescale that you have. But we think that there is endless assistance that you can give to public authorities in just educating authorities to what the things that and steps they should be taking early on in the process that will facilitate an effective procurement.
Jake has someone in the back, but last comment, what Regina mentioned earlier with our P3 value tools, I mean, that ties in very nicely with your last suggestion. We are working very hard on developing a set of tools that gives the project sponsors a very thorough understanding of the rigorous process that should be undertaken when determining whether or not a project is appropriate for delivery via P3. So thank you so much for saying that.
And Deborah, you might want to also mention the work that Patrick is doing on, it's really for our division offices, but we're developing a document that lays out all the federal requirements.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Division offices in a lot of instances are coming to this process fairly new too and are asking, you know, what should I be doing? How should I be working with my state counterparts in helping to prepare a project for P3 delivery? Federal requirements still apply, but the process and the order may be a little bit different because our federal requirements were developed prior to anybody thinking about public-private partnerships as a delivery option. So we're working on that guide to better assist the states along the way in complying with the federal requirements. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Mike Mathieu. I'm with Hogan Lovells. Addressing your question as to whether you want a complete contract or whether you want contract terms and how all that piece works, to my mind, I think the first thing you need to do is step back and decide what is the risk allocation, what is the package that you're going to put together as an overall piece. And it comes to Andy's point concerning education and newbie state DOTs when they come to this and looking at it and understanding that, you know, there's no free lunch and there is, in very real terms, retained risk for the public sector as well as risk transfer to the private sector. Because drafting a number of contract terms, as it were, in isolation doesn't really make a lot of sense because one part of a contract is intimately related to another and you push in one side and something pops up the other side. So my suggestion would be first you stand back and decide what the risk allocation is you need to achieve in your contract, picking up Andy's point, and give guidance to authorities with regard to, for example, if you're going to impose the risk of unforeseen ground conditions on the private sector, then they've got to have a reasonable amount of data that they can rely on as to what those ground conditions are, to take something that's completely obvious. So identify the risk allocation, how you want to achieve it, and then having got that piece sorted out, then there will be some contract provisions that are definitely worth drafting, but you won't need to draft, for example, confidentiality clauses, and nor would it be sensible to do so because state freedom of information legislation varies so widely, to take one example. So get the risk allocation, have that as something that's coherent, and contract drafting of particular clauses can slot into that overall picture.
Okay, thank you.
Jake, there's a gentleman back there.
This is Matt Gill with Transurban. I think the goal of this should be to formalize and make available on a national scale what's already happening kind of on an ad hoc basis already. You know, if you see that Pennsylvania is writing their legislation, setting up their P3 office based on Virginia, or if you see that, you know, at Transurban, our I-95 documentation was very similar, or we borrowed heavily from the work that we'd done on Capitol Beltway, you see that the learning process is happening organically already. If you see, you know, the Western Infrastructure Exchange that California, Oregon, Washington, BC is setting up, that's meant to share best practices. And I think this effort should be to kind of formalize that and bring it up to a national scale and make that more widely available versus, one-off efforts as they are today.
So are you're saying something more educational, more of a cafeteria menu approach? Or
I think it should be to shorten, the goal should be to shorten the learning curve. I think standardization is kind of off the table because of the unique nature of these projects and the unique nature of the political jurisdictions. But if you were to say, you know, if you were to go to Virginia or Texas or a state that's done this a lot of times and say, here's now your model contract, they'd probably say, no, thank you, we already know how we like to do it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the goal should be to bring others who want to join this market, you know, up to speed so they don't have to spend a couple of years spinning their wheels on stuff that has already been established by the market players.
Thank you.
Thanks, and general impression so far in the room is that this should be swinging more towards the educational side. Certainly if there's anybody who disagrees or thinks that the pendulum should be swinging more towards the standardization side, please feel free to let us know. We'd like to hear from you.
You were thinking exactly what I was thinking. I'm just fixing to ask that. And really, if there's anybody that has a contrary view, we would like to hear that. Do we have anybody from a state DOT in the room?
Yes.
Okay, if I could impose on one of you gentlemen to kind of give your perspective, and where are you from?
Virginia.
Oh, Virginia. You're up there on the learning curve. And you? Okay, good. Well, do either one of you have anything that you'd like to contribute? And maybe Tamar, if you wanted to weigh in, because you've been in the midst. Tamar's working on the Ohio River Bridges project, and certainly to Kentucky and Indiana, that was a very new concept, very new approach. In fact, it's new for the country, the approach that they're taking. So I'll start with you.
Given the mic, Regina.
I don't like to keep up my microphone.
Well, thank you. Morteza Farajan from Virginia DOT. This year, as you know, we procured three P3 projects, Midtown project in Hampton Road, we had I-95 express lanes, and finally we had Route 460 corridor improvements project. And one of the things that we learned is that even though we have three different P3 projects, each one of them are different. One of them is a tunnel project, the other one is HOT lanes, and the other one is a greenfield project. Three different projects. Something that I want to mention is that even though we have three different contracts, there are a lot of provisions that are similar. Maybe we can just talk about how we can split the contract into different sections or different pieces. One piece is talking about all these program level provisions. For example, provisions related to DB or SWAM. Provisions related to security package that is required. I mean, it could be specific to the project, but in general, the state might have a level that they want to retain, or retainage in general. I mean, how FHWA wants to deal with retainage, because I remember that was one of the discussions that we had with the FHWA Virginia division quite late in the process, and it was difficult for us to go back and make changes. So those program level provisions are the ones that I think we can focus on right now. And back to Andy's comments and DJ's comments, maybe we can just focus on what has to be in the contract from FHWA perspective. And then after that, we can move to what has to be in the contract from state level perspective. That could be a little bit different between different states, because each state has a different business model, business decisions. There are different risk mechanisms that one state could be familiar with and is ready to take, the other state cannot take. So it's a little bit more difficult to talk about that state level or project level provisions, but that program level provisions are probably the easier to tackle first. And another thing is that since this is, I believe that you're going to develop only one standardized contract, not one for tunnel projects, one for HOT projects, one for, right. So that's another thing, because if you stay at that program level, we can talk about some stuff, some provision that goes to all of those contracts. But if you want to get more and more focus, it's going to be more and more difficult. And each project is different. Negotiations are different depending on how competitive the procurement is, depending on characteristics of the project. Many provisions can vary, and it would be very difficult to come up with one set of documents.
Thank you.
Jake has a gentleman.
I'm sorry I put you on the spot.
Brad Schiff from Parsons Springcroft. I think what would be really useful is if we could just help get everybody talking about the same things in the same way. So if we can frame out what some of the common issues are on projects. So for example, who takes risk of hazardous materials? That comes up on almost every project. And there's a range of options over which the risk can be shared. So if we could kind of go through and frame out what the different common issues are, get everybody thinking about them the same way, and then present a range of options over which people can choose, because not one option is going to work for every single project. Each project has its own unique things and has to have a different risk share in order to make it, you know, economical. So I think to the extent we can create a menu of options, that makes it easier for people to understand, it makes everybody talk on the same level, and it makes people be able to do these things faster, but it doesn't prescribe the way in which we have to structure a deal.
And I can't help but observing from your comment that you talked some about what should be included in a model contract and a template, and also a little bit about education in terms of looking at risk and evaluating risk. And again, going back to Patrick has done some work on that. That's on our website. But I'm taking note that that's probably something that we need to do more of. It's probably not so germane to this conversation, but it's an important thing for us to take back.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think our experience has been certainly working with public agencies, that there's a lot of work, one, educating them on what the issues are, and then helping them understand what their range of options are, and then beyond that, helping them decide what the best choice to make is.
Okay, thank you. Great. And was there someone?
What is in that matrix? What are the elements of that matrix? What are the issues that you put on that matrix?
And Brina, I'm sorry, we're going to get to that. We're not there right now. That's coming up later in the day.
Okay.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Was there somebody over here?
Well, Regina, I was going to ask. We've heard a lot from this side.
Great. I was just going to say, that's right. Yes.
Mark, what are your people saying?
Well, I'd just like to say the people on this side of the room are very thoughtful, and they've been listening very, very closely. I do think it would be a shame for us to get to the perspective of state DOTs without talking to a representative from the great state of Florida. Happen to have just here at my left Leon Corbett from Florida DOT, and I'm going to give him permission to talk about just anything he wants.
Thanks, Mark. This might take a while. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and You know, I've been nodding my head as I've heard about the educational approach that people are desiring. And, you know, just from a public agency perspective, we have very complex documents in our concession agreements. And when you're explaining to your colleagues how things work, just having a reference tool, even for our own document, is difficult at times. So anything you can do to point to existing references and get the public folks there quicker. I think, you know, the matrix idea was a good idea. Just, you know, getting us to specific provisions that are out there in existing contracts. I mean, we all kind of work in a progression off of what's out there already, and certainly Florida will be probably working off of I-595 when it pursues its next availability payment deal. So we have our advisors with us, we have our lawyers in the office, but anything that is educational and gets you quickly to other examples and explains the synopsis, the background behind the deal, would be helpful.
Thank you, Leon. Any other states on this side that we missed? Okay. It's probably time to move on, but
I think not yet.
Okay. I think that the overall consensus, yes. The overall consensus so far is educational, big time.
Yeah, so maybe from a one way to look at it or break it down is maybe to look at some set of principles. The design, bid, build process, and that mix of federal and state funds has really served us well. I mean, it's brought us where we are today. And there's certain elements within that that I think, you know, to ensure that we, you know, have the safety, the cost controls that leave us with system preservation so that down the road, and that I think, as you said earlier, kind of getting, making sure, ensuring we get value for taxpayers and users. And I think part of that, and one of the things that we think believe strongly, is the proper oversight and inspection, which, you know, includes boots on the ground, and basically the separation, and I guess in terms of a broader separation between having somebody look out for the public that works for the public, as opposed to, you know, a contractor hiring a contractor to do inspection and saying, you know, you've done a good job, and many times that works, but in the long run, I think it can't work because there's, you know, money involved with it. And so just to ensure that again, that principle or that doesn't get lost as we move to, you know, these new ways of delivering projects. Another piece is just the, I keep hearing project delivery, you know, is being accelerated and not being touted, but it still seems to me that in most cases they're not really dealing with the first two-thirds of project delivery, when you have to talk about right-of-way, environmental, utility, permitting, the financial stuff. That all, you know, that's the first two-thirds, I think, of project delivery, and most of this stuff focuses on the last third, where you're actually doing design and construction. So. Just something to think about.
Okay, thank you. Tamar, did you have something to add?
I guess echoing the comments in terms of erring towards samples and less prescriptive from states I've worked with in terms of how, I mean, for all the issues in terms of state statute, the risk-sharing comments that have been made, I think all of those sort of line up nicely to suggest that the less prescriptive approach is appropriate. I guess adding a further reason for that to think about is that a sample document from USDOT carries different weight, I think, out there than a sample document, let's say, from a trade association or some other player. And so you can call it a sample, but in the hands of a given legislator or executive in a state, it may come around as, well, it's, you know, it says here we have to do it this way. And it's very, I think, hard for some states to wiggle out of that, no, DOT, it's just a sample. And so you may, well, I think there's often times where it helps states to have something they can point to that says, well, we kind of have to do it this way. It also could tie their hands in a way, again, because it's not from a third-party entity, but rather from the federal government and funder, co-funder on a lot of these projects.
I think that's a really interesting observation, and in fact, we've talked about that internally. Is there anyone that would like to add to that? I'd like to perhaps hear just a little bit more conversation about that.
Sorry, I know I spoke earlier, but I just wanted to make two follow-on points just to underscore some of the points that have been said. I think the first point is that, whether or not, from my perspective, it doesn't really matter who produces a standard contract. What really matters is the extent to which the documentation that's produced explains the reason why the recommended provisions or sample provisions are the way they are. The reality is that most concession agreements, in terms of the provisions that really dictate value to the procuring authority of that contract, are relatively similar from project to project. We as lawyers are not advocating not having standard contracts because we're worried about our lunch being eaten. 90% of the fees that we earn are earned explaining why contracts are written the way they are written. Actually, putting the words on paper doesn't take that much time, right? Once we know and the client has agreed what's going to be written, it really doesn't take that much time. Also, if you look around the world at jurisdictions that have actually written very credible guidance or sample contracts, those documents run to hundreds and hundreds of pages, the more credible ones. And a very few number of pages are actually sample contractual provisions. The bulk of the information is explaining, takes the procuring authority and the private sector on a journey to explain why best practice is the way it is. And there's some very comprehensive information around the world. A lot of the positions that have been reached in the US to date are very much reflective of that guidance from around the world. And finally, I think you can't isolate the contractual terms from the holistic nature of the procurement process. And to give you an example, it is very much the case that you could take a different approach to the way you write a contract and the way you allocate risks in a contract if you have a lowest priced bid type procurement as opposed to a procurement process that has evaluation criteria that are not solely focused towards price. So if you have material percentage of your marks in evaluation that are associated towards design, that is also going to influence the way in which the contractual terms actually work.
Thank you.
Thank you. DJ?
I spoke before, but also wanted to just circle back. I think one thing to be avoided that everyone would agree with is we don't want a lowest common denominator type exercise. So there are states that have an incredible amount of expertise already. I would not view this exercise as being necessarily particularly helpful to them. I think what would be very, very helpful is for states that are getting into this for the first time, providing them with the tools we talked about in terms of education and maybe some key ways to approach different terms would be contractual. But one thing to be avoided, going back to the comment about if this comes from the federal government, does that mean that now my contract has to look like this, is that you want the Texases and Virginias and the Floridas to kind of keep doing what they're doing because they've got it down. They've got a bit of a rhythm. Puerto Rico I'd throw in there as well. But the new states coming on board, like Pennsylvania that's just getting started, this could be an incredibly valuable tool for them to help understand what these provisions are, how they allocate risk, and what the market is doing.
Okay, Mark, I think you have someone.
Hi, I'm Brian Deary. I'm with the Associated General Contractors. I'm nodding my head about a lot of the comments that have been made around the room. We too would advocate for as much flexibility, but also a lot of education. We look at it for our members' point of view. Our members could be involved on the concessionaire team as an equity partner or as a design-build contractor. either way. And so the contract clauses that are included in there, the ones that are included in the concession agreement, are important because those all flow down. There's a wealth of knowledge out there in the DOTs. I mean, they've learned over the years that risk allocation is important in their traditional design, bid, build, construction programs, and they've learned that if they retain the risk themselves, certain risks, that they get a much more costly, cost-efficient project. And I think that we can't lose that concept as we go into the PPPs. So when we talk about a matrix, I would like to see included as part of the matrix also the constructor's point of view.
Oh, yeah. Jake has someone?
I think in terms of what's going to be on the template design here, and one thing that we're not, we haven't heard mentioned yet, I'm sorry, this is Chadron Edwards from Chadbourne and Park. One thing to keep in mind, especially when considering the scope of what a model agreement from the DOT is going to look like, is how often are you going to be able to update this, and how often are you going to be able to continue to keep this current? If we look at other forms that certain entities put out for other types of transactions, you know, those are updated on a yearly or sometimes even more frequent basis than that. And those are forms that are very prescriptive and they have very specific provisions in them. Others that are not updated as frequently, you know, are a little bit more general and skew a little bit more towards the educational side. But I think that's one thing that has to be kept in mind here, where if we're going to be very prescriptive, you know, is it in the ability of the DOT to continue to update this? What we don't want to do is bring together the industry and bring together everyone in the room here, work for 12 months very hard on something that is only really useful for another year or less. These things evolve very quickly. As we know, the market in the U.S., what you would see as a typical provision today is nothing like you would imagine it would have been 5 years ago. And so these things continue to evolve. And if we're going to be very prescriptive, we need to consider how we can keep the document relevant.
That's an excellent point.
Thank you.
Steve has a comment.
I'm Steve Howard with Barclays. I've discussed with several people in the room here the experience we went through a number of years ago with a similar practice in the municipal waste to energy industry in the US EPA that was playing a similar role in the development of that market back in the 70s and 80s. And there was a very similar process that the industry went through where the EPA set up some examples of contract terms and provisions. And where that whole exercise ended up was something along the lines of the second bullet point, but rather than recommended language for common provisions, it was really more along the lines of commentary around common provisions that would appear, it could appear in contracts. It was a fairly exhaustive list, but frankly, the primary benefit of that effort and the product of that effort was, as we all, I think, already agreed, was education for the executive and legislative branches of the decision-making bodies on the public side to serve as sort of a framework and education tool for staff members, for example, to put everything in perspective as decisions were being made about specific projects, how to procure them, how to contract for them. That was, frankly, the most useful tool for those parties to these major transactions. The actual implementing entities on the public side obviously had retained advisors and were taking those provisions or other contracts that included those provisions to the more much more detailed level to implement. So I would. It seems to me where we're headed is more along the lines of education, a check-the-box type of concept, which was, in fact, the experience we went through with this other exercise 20 or 30 years ago.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Mark, you had Nick?
Nick Donahue with Transportation for America. And I agree with a lot of what folks have kind of said here today, but I want to add one kind of slight twist to that. And that's with a lot of this educational materials, particularly those related to public protections and things of that nature, I think it's important that the type of language that's used can be accessible both to like staff in the negotiating room, but also to folks that serve on like state transportation policy boards and other types of policymakers. And an example of why I think that's really important is a lot of policymakers know that they don't want a non-compete clause in their P3 agreement because that can constrain their ability to expand capacity in the future. But at the same time, most of those folks have no clue that compensation events now can also potentially constrain their ability to expand capacity kind of in the future. And I think the knowledge base in the public sector is always a little bit slower than that of the private sector, and the staff sometimes in the room can keep up, but those folks who actually vote on these agreements, who kind of tell the staff what to look for in these agreements, may not be able or be as up to speed as the private sector folks. And so I think that's really important, particularly for the public protections, but also to make sure that the public still supports P3s as we move forward, because this is something that we do need. And sometimes if they go too far, you could see moratoriums or other things put in place. And I think that would be a big downside.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ed?
Yeah, I wanted to pile onto Steve's comment about commentary. And one of the factors that I'm aware of is that I think maybe most of the audience here is oriented towards highways, but I think these standard contracts need to address all surface transportation modes, right? So to the extent that we have transit or rail, I'm seeing quizzical looks at the podium. Is that not correct, or?
I think it's geared towards highways. Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
I'm sorry, I think it's geared towards highways at this point. Mm-hmm.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I was just looking at the Federal Register notice. It looked like it was broader than that.
And
but
I believe that if I could impose on my colleague from FTA, I believe that FTA has their own requirement in legislation.
Yeah. My name, by the way, is Tom Yednak, and I work for the Federal Transit Administration. This is really, it's great to be a part of this, and this is FHWA show, and I'm very pleased to be here to participate and to listen to all of your comments. We, too, the FTA, have a little bit of a different focus in terms of our requirements in MAP 21, but yet we don't have a specific deadline per se on model contracting, but yet we are required, as Ed, as you pointed out, to come up with standardized model contracts as well. So I'm pleased to be here and to be a part of, I'm pleased that Regina invited me and to be a part of this. We at appropriate time will be doing our outreach as well, but we also have a similar requirement and look forward to hearing your comments as well as it relates, as it could be relate to transit. So appreciate that.
Well, okay, but in any event, I still agree with Steve's comment that commentary and guidance and to the earlier comment too about addressing this to a level where maybe less sophisticated, less experienced staff members can appreciate the arguments and the issues, and keeping it broad, I think will serve us all well.
Great. Mark?
Just to add, I'm kind of excited listening to this conversation about the opportunity for the USDOT to get educated. It's not as though we are the leading experts here and know about every deal and every nuance, every trade-off, every question, and are just, you know, figuring out the right way to deliver that. I think the very process that we're talking about going through over the next 12, 15 months and forever on, and the process we've been on in the last 4 or 5 years, just indicative of the fact that we're all kind of marching down on this road together, and I think we'll all get a lot smarter. And one of the great products isn't the standard contracts themselves, but just the fact that we've all gone through that process, and you know, individually and collectively, we're all a lot smarter.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. And with that, I'm going to tee up the next broad topic.